Hello to all of you out there. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to take a little dip back into our discussion of Portland, Oregon, and then we're going to move on with two new books by very exciting authors.
Yeah. It's got a sort of a potpourri of a program again.
Well, I guess so. Well, we're talking chef with Park Kitchen.
Yeah, we're talking another chef and restaurant owner, Lewis Lambert, and then we're talking about a guy who invented chefing in a rather unusual way with a, at least to us, a rather unusual dish. But you'll hear about that in due course. First of all, Scott Dolich has not one but two restaurants in Portland, Oregon, which is perhaps why he's such a busy man and we didn't catch up with him until after we got back to the studio. But his two places, Park Kitchen and Bent Brick, are the subject of our interview, which I'm sure you'll enjoy.
Scott Dolich, we've had a little trouble catching up with each other here, but we had no trouble at all eating at your wonderful restaurant, Park Kitchen. Well, one of your two restaurants, actually, in Portland, Oregon. The other one is, actually, you distinguish it as probably more about drinking than eating, called Bent Brick.
That is correct.
Tell us why it's called Bent Brick.
The name for the Bent Brick came about more through a description of the location. It's a beautiful old turn-of-the-century brick building that's shaped like an L. And we didn't really want to call it a restaurant or a tavern or a bar. And the Bent Brick was a catchy name. It's easy to say and easy to remember.
Great. Well, now, let's jump back a little bit. And you are not a native Portland, Oregon, right?
I am not, no. Originally, I'm New York.
All right, so, I mean, there's a little bit of explaining to do. How did you get from New York to Portland, Oregon?
There is a little bit of a history. So from New York, I moved to North Carolina, to Durham, North Carolina, and that's where I got my start cooking. I was working for a butchery in Durham. That was my very first kitchen job when I was 20. And from there, moved out to San Francisco and worked for Loretta Keller of Coco 500.
Oh, wonderful woman, yeah.
Brad Ogden
at
the Lark Creek Inn. And for Michael Mina when he was the chef at Aqua.
And oh, my God. You were at Aqua?
I was.
That goes back a place.
Yeah, you probably prepared some things for us when we were there.
Wonderful restaurant in the day.
Yeah, isn't it funny that he ends up with another restaurant named for himself,
yes.
Right in the same place where he started Aqua.
Exactly, but it's evidently doing very well there. And then from there, moved up to Portland.
Right. And why did you pick Portland?
I moved up here after I graduated college to be with friends and not originally planning to stay. I was originally planning to travel through Europe. I was wanting to go to Spain and to France and to gain experience there, but ended up really falling in love with Portland. It was just, it was a great time to be in Portland. The restaurant scene was just exploding, and the ingredients were eye-opening to me, and I just decided to stay.
What year was that?
I came out to Portland in 1992.
Oh, wow, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, that's kind of sticky, huh?
Yeah. It was a long, I've been here for, yeah. Almost,
Greg Higgins, I guess, was one of the leaders at that point, right? Who were some of the other people you were working with then?
Absolutely. Greg Higgins was he had just kind of started working at the Heathman Hotel. He didn't even have his own restaurant then.
Okay, right.
And Chris Israel at Zephyro, which was one of the places where I worked, and Dave Machado at Pazzo Restaurant were some of the big names back then.
Well, the big names now include the Park Kitchen, right?
I hope so. It seems to be doing okay for itself.
Well, explain the location of the Park Kitchen, because I think that's part of the charm of it. We sat sort of outside, just outside the door, overlooking the park.
It is. The traditional wisdom has location, location, location as part of the top part of your business plan. And I'm a big fan of that. I'm not exactly a fan of traditional locations. I like beautiful locations, and I think that Park Kitchen fits the bill. It's in this idyllic swath of parks that stretch through the Pearl District, at the very end of the Pearl District, and it's not quite Tony, and it's not quite seedy, but it's very kind of lush, and in the summertime, it's wonderful to sit outside and enjoy a meal out there.
And it's really funny because the other end of the park stretch that goes all the way to the middle of Portland is the Portland Farmers Market.
correct.
At Portland State University. So you don't have to, you probably walk when you go down there.
We do. We've got a bunch of crew that are big bike fans, and so we either ride our bikes or walk down to the farmer's market. Most days we have to kind of scramble for a car. There might be one out of eight people that actually take their car.
Well, what a wonderful farmer's market it is.
Yes, I heard you guys had a nice Saturday at the farmer's market.
Oh, I just loved it.
Yeah, we spent about two hours there, and we didn't buy anything.
Yeah,
so you can imagine, and we've been to not just some of the top farmers markets in this country, we've been to some of the top farmers markets in the world, and this is a world-class market that you have in Portland, Oregon, and I was absolutely amazed at the output, the range of output of the agriculture in Portland. I mean, I guess you think of Oregon as being a mountainous state, not necessarily an agricultural state, but clearly it obviously is.
Yes, it's a tremendous agricultural output, and I would agree with you. I would put our farmers market up against any. Whenever I travel, I make it a point to go to any of the farmers markets where we visit, and I think the Portland farmers market is absolutely the tops. I was very proud to serve as a board member of the farmers market a few years ago.
Oh, that's great. So you were putting something back into it as well. That's really nice.
I was definitely trying.
Well, you know, everybody uses it. It's not even just professional chefs or, you know, I mean, it seemed like there was a cross-section of the whole of Portland, Oregon there.
It really is. There's you see families there making a nice morning out of it and getting their coffee and kids playing and obviously people buying produce and stocking up for the week. And there's a number of other ones that go throughout the week, so it's not just Saturday. You can stock up on vegetables and meats and seafoods.
Great. Now that's directly reflected in what you serve at Park Kitchen, right?
Yeah, the vegetables are certainly the inspiration for what we do. Whenever I sit down with David Padberg, my chef there, we always, the first thing that we go to are the vegetables that are coming in, because that's really the thing that changes the most frequently. So that's really, the vegetables are our inspiration, and that's, I think, the thing that most people are surprised about when they come into Park Kitchen, is just the diversity of vegetables and the treatment of vegetables that they get.
You have some really unusual heritage grains on your menu, which impressed me all just totally, including Frika. you never see that on a menu.
Yeah,
we knew it from the people in Australia who were making it and their story and everything, but I'm surprised it hasn't been picked up by more people.
Well, I sure would hope that it does get picked up by more people. That's grown for us by one of our farmers in Gaston, Oregon, Anthony and Carol Boutard from Ayers Creek. And they're wonderful people, and they have almost single-handedly resuscitated that grain for this area. People clamor for it now.
It was started out as sort of a peasant grain in the Middle East.
Right.
And it was
discovered by the people of this town that was under siege by somebody else in the land between the rivers. If you remember, they picked the grain green.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because they wanted to have something, even if it wasn't ripe, they wanted to have something. And then because the grain was unripe and wet, it exploded. But
yes,
then they discovered that it tasted good anyway.
And it does.
It's sort of like the story of the Chinese man who invented roast pork.
Yes, and one of the other treatments of that grain specifically is that they burn it, they torch it, which helps to preserve it in a way, and it lends a really delicious, smoky, mysterious overtone to it. And like you said, it is harvested green, which is unusual, and it too adds to that kind of interesting, unfamiliar flavor, but it's wheat after all, which is...
Yeah, but you know, the guy who commercialized production of it in Australia actually said that Frika is not the grain so much as it is the process. So
oh,
you could do it with other grains too. Interesting.
So you could do Freaky Barley and Freaky Oats. And
huh?
All kinds of things. Freaky Faro. Boy, that would be funny, huh?
Well, the other thing I loved seeing on your menu, because Peter and I fight about it all the time, is purslane, because I forage it from our garden, and he thinks it's a weed. But
yeah.
I said, everything in Portland seems to be garnished with purslane.
Well, we certainly can grow lots of green, weedy-type things here 11 months out of the year. The purslane is one of our favorites. It's a delicious, almost succulent leaf that has a fairly lemony overtone to it, and we use it in lieu of lemon juice sometimes, where we'll garnish with purslane or we'll make a salad with purslane, and it actually has an acidity to it that sets off the other ingredients in the salad.
I love it. I just think it's great. And you know, the first time we had it was, outside of the weeds in our garden, was at the Waterside Inn in Bray, England.
Right.
And they charge a pretty good penny for it. I'll tell you, we call it a weed or what.
Well, you get some other fun things too, though, like amaranth greens.
Amaranth greens
with beets.
Yes, and chickweed is prevalent on our menu now.
And you had some wonderful beans called poacher beans with some kind of pork sausage. That was wonderful too.
Yes, the fresh beans. Those poacher beans are supplied to us by Viridian Farms, which is down near Grand Island, about an hour south of where we're located. And they have a wonderful buttery flavor. And those poacher beans can be dried as well, but I prefer to serve them fresh out of the pod.
Why don't you have him walk us through some of those dishes?
Well, I've been in the process of doing that, actually.
Oh, okay.
And I have the list, and I'm not sure whether Scott actually knows the list.
I do.
But we did have the baby octopus with the padrone peppers, which were just everywhere.
Which I adore those peppers.
And then there was a special herb with that. And then tell us about the angry sauce.
The angry sauce is Italian in origin, and it's just a very simple spicy tomato sauce.
Arrabbiata.
The arrabbiata is the Italian name. We prefer to try to use English terminology on our menus just because that's one of my preferences. But the arrabbiata sauce was the basis for that sauce. And the padrones that you talked about have become very, very popular out here. And they're a small green pepper that can be spicy. 1 out of 20 is estimated to be fairly spicy. But by and large, they're just a delicious, very vegetal green pepper. The traditional way to serve them is simply sautéed with olive oil and garnished with a little coarse salt.
Yeah, they were serving samples of that at the farmer's market.
Now, that dish comes with baby octopus. Is that local to the seas off the coast of Portland?
Just off the
coast of Oregon?
The baby octopus we're actually getting from the waters off of Mexico, which is about as far as we'll go.
Okay.
To get our seafood. But that happens to be a delicious dish. We wanted to kind of mimic the texture of those wonderful padrone chilies, and the baby octopus do that marvelously.
But you do have a local fishery that's pretty good, because your restaurant and, in fact, at another restaurant we were at while we were in Poland, both of them were serving albacore tuna from Oregon waters.
Yes, and the albacore tuna is a great success story for the local fisheries. It's a seasonal fishery. We only get those albacore fresh from roughly July through September, and a lovely kind of pink flesh fish. It's not the same as tombo, which is a deeper water tuna. These are a fast-running tuna from the surface, and the ones that we get are line-caught and simply treated, whether very delicately poached in olive oil or grilled. It's just a lovely, lovely fish to serve.
Well, you know, you have so many wonderful ingredients available, like all those hazelnuts you grow.
Yes.
You like hazelnuts.
They are, my cooks kind of joke on me about hazelnuts in particular, because that's one of my first suggestions to put on any and all dishes, is to put some toasted hazelnuts on them. They have to kind of rein me back. but they are certainly one of our local delicacies, and I feel like it's something that Oregon cooks should be proud of, because they're an expensive ingredient, and we are the leading grower in the U.S. outside of, I believe, Turkey.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, if you haven't figured it out by now, the dining style at Park Kitchen is very much small plates, small cold plates and small hot plates. If you get a tasting menu, it's composed of all small plates.
Yes, that is one of the options that I believe you guys had.
We did, because you said we should.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of a no-fail situation for us. We have such a high success rate with that small plate tasting menu, because it's always a surprise, and we get to highlight what we're very much proud of. It's not that we're not proud of the whole menu, but oftentimes we'll make a new change and we're really proud of a new dish and we'll put that on there, and when the cooks are super excited about it, it ends up showing in the final presentation. And it's also a fun way to try a good portion of the menu without getting totally stuffed.
Oh, that's exactly what this is exactly the way we will always eat if we have the chance. But I was also transitioning as well, because if that's the dining style at Park Kitchen, the small plate bites is very much the cuisine of Bent Brick as well.
It is, even more so, really. Bent Brick, the initial concept for the Bent Brick was to make more of a tavern, although it's very hard for me to let go of good food, so that's what we're trying to do, is create a tavern that has really great food, and we're very much wrapped up in serving small dishes there, but it's just a little bit more alcohol focused. We've got 16 wines on tap there at the Bent Brick, and wonderful bar manager Adam Robinson, who's using all domestic spirits to mix his cocktails with, which is an interesting concept that is, I think, rapidly taking on here.
And a lot of those are probably locally produced in the Portland area, right?
Most of them are, yeah. We've got a really great local artisan spirits scene happening here, and where we try to support them the best we can.
Well, you know, the thing I like really about this whole culinary community in Portland is how much you like each other, all you guys and gals, and you know, and share, and you have such a good time, and everybody else has a good time, and you're not jealous or anything each other, and you socialize, don't you?
Definitely socialize, and I would classify it as a kind of a healthy competition almost. And my logic is that we're making some fantastic products, and why shouldn't we support each other? Certainly not that we dislike saffron or imported olives or imported vodka or imported wine, for that matter. It's just that we know these people, and we get to see them. They come into the restaurant. They enjoy what we do, and we want to support them, too.
Yeah, well, you have plenty of resources there. I mean, yeah. I forget your wine list. Is that mainly Arrakhan, or?
At the Bent Brick, we certainly specialize in local Pinot Noirs, and we pride ourselves in having a really diverse list of local wines there. The Bent Brick is even more so. Of those 16 wines on tap, they're all local.
Good thing. That's the way it ought to be.
Yep.
Let's hear it for Arrakhan and Scott Dolich. Thank you so much for establishing these wonderful places. We didn't get to the Bent Brick, but we'll certainly get there the next time we're in
town.
There's
always some place new that we have to go back to. We still haven't been to Beast.
No, we haven't been to Beast. We haven't been to Le Pigeon yet.
Oh, yeah, but we know his cooking.
We know Gabe.
Gabe and his cooking, because we've tasted his food. We just never went to the restaurant, yeah.
It's always good to have another reason to come back, right?
Yes, well, we just found, one of our favorite tea makers is from there, too, and I didn't realize it until we were ready to go.
David Smith.
Pete Smith.
You didn't remember that?
Hmm?
Yeah.
You didn't remember that? Huh?
Not until we were about to leave.
Well, they had his tea down at the Allison. He's such a nice guy.
That's what made me remember. Yeah. And then,
his shop is four blocks away from the Bent Brick.
Okay. Really?
And then there's the salt guy.
Oh, yeah.
The Meadow.
The Meadow. We missed him because he was out of town. But anyway,
we feel like we're sort of part of that scene anymore. So we have so many friends there. And again, I just thought Park Kitchen was just a delight, and we had a wonderful time.
Well, that's always a pleasure to hear.
Yeah.
So thank you, and we'll see you again one of these days.
Pretty soon.
Nice talking to you guys.
Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye.
And now don't go away, because we'll be right back after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
So here we are again, and boy, I'm always impressed at how lucid and thoughtful and well-spoken he is.
Right.
Yeah. And this next guest, Lou Lambert.
He's the same.
Lewis Lambert is the same.
He's making
a huge impact and getting a lot of press on his latest book. It's the first time that he's released the recipes from his restaurants.
What's it called? Big Ranch, Big City?
Yes.
And we also might say Big Restaurant.
Big State.
We might say Big Restaurant.
Big Restaurant, Big State.
Yeah, Big State.
Big ideas, big everything.
Texas wines on the wine list. This man has it covered. I'm sure you're going to enjoy hearing what he has to say.
I was going to start by singing The Stars at Night.
Please don't do that.
Deep in the heart of Texas. And see, there you go.
Well, this cookbook is absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, the essence of Texas. It's big, it's bold, it's rich, multi-layers, lots of multicultural references, and it's called Big Ranch, Big City.
And it's almost as good as my singing.
Yes, and it's by Lou, if you will, Lambert, with June Naylor.
Correct.
And you two started the Texas Old Ways, right?
The Texas Food Ways, yes.
Yeah,
we were part of that original group that came together to start that organization, which is kind of a offshoot of Southern Food Ways.
Right, that's the one I know, yeah.
Oh, so
yeah.
that's linked up with John Edge, the guy at
University
of Mississippi?
Yes, a lot of the folks involved with Southern Food Ways, which I was at arm's length, got together and we talked about, you know, we are very unique. Yes, we're part of the South, but we're part of the Southwest here in Texas, and our food heritage and culture is just kind of unique. So we thought that it was worth starting our own food group.
Right.
Which
besides, you are a republic in your own right, correct?
Well, we were, and there are some folks who would like to see that change and become one again.
I guess I started working on writing something about my home county in England, which is called Yorkshire, and it's the largest county.
Yeah.
And Yorkshiremen have the same kind of attitude to the nation of England as Texans do to the nation of the United States.
Well, so you can kind of understand.
Yeah, exactly, theater. Exactly. I can understand.
Well, listen, I want to say that, Louis, you have such a complicated, rich background. I was really impressed. You've got, well, of course, you have all the, you're in Western Texas. You've got all the Mexican references. You're mother's family was Arcadian, French Arcadian?
No, my mother's family were, so on that side, seven generations. I'm the seventh of Texans in the cattle business.
Well,
and then on my father, it was that French Arcadian.
Okay,
background.
So he was the one, that's where all that hunting comes from, which was wonderful. It reminds me of talking to people in New Orleans.
That he was in Louisiana, and all his people, and actually he traces back, or we do on his side, of some of the original descendants from settling in Louisiana.
You add on to that not only were you raised in that kind of an environment with all that food, all the available product and so forth, but you also then went off and you were professionally trained, formerly trained at the Culinary Institute of America, then worked in the big cities in New York and San Francisco before returning to Texas. But you're really
correct.
A Texas son.
I am, and as all chefs, when you're first starting out, you think you're going to light the world on fire and get out and become the next big thing. But it was through those experiences, through culinary school, through working in big cities and big white tablecloth restaurants, did it finally dawn on me, you know what? We have just as much to be proud of, and such is in as big of food heritage and culture as anywhere in the United States, and it's something I can be proud of. And that's when I decided to come back to Texas and kind of embrace what we have here.
But married with your experience with the and your education in French technique.
Correct, because when you really get down to it, whether you're making a boudin blanc or some kind of fancy sausage with pheasant, a sausage is a sausage, and we were making beautiful hot links smoked on grills here in Texas, and it's actually the same technique as well as a lot of things we do. It's just using the ingredients that are indigenous to Texas.
Now, you've got quite a restaurant empire.
Well, do you want to buy one? I'll
see. No, I didn't
you,
say that. But
you snuck that in, didn't you?
but you do have more than one place.
Yes, and kind of that go across the gamut. In Austin, my sister and I have the Two Joes kind of coffee shop cafe. We've got Lambert's Downtown Barbecue that we do everything from all-natural brisket, make our own sausage, to fresh seafood, wood-burning grill, Wagyu steak. To in Fort Worth, we have Lambert's Steak and Seafood, and then Dutch's Hamburgers, kind of a hamburger beer joint across from Texas Christian University.
Wow, that's an empire.
So this book is sort of a distillation of that experience. Is it intended to appeal to people that would go to your restaurants, or is it more of a sort of a statement of, no, this is my credo?
Both. When I was doing the cookbook, I wanted to do something that represented not just me and kind of my culinary career, but also what it means to me to grow up in Texas and to embrace my culture as a Texan. So when we put the book together, and hence the name Big Ranch, Big City, the ranch part being my youth and where I see myself today is someone living here in Texas, and based on the foods of my youth, the chicken and dumplings and gumbos and a lot of smoked and grilled meats, to the big city portion of the book, which are recipes based from the restaurant. And I think it gives us a good mix of recipes, both from my perspective and the home cook who's wanting to cook sometimes very simple and straightforward. They could do a cheddar gratin, or from the restaurant end of it, something more complicated using classical techniques, beurre blancs and sauces.
You have a large section just on stocks and sauces, which you don't. You're not going to get from a routine Texas barbecue book.
No, it's much more than just kind of that Texas grilling and barbecue.
Somebody told us that his father taught him how to make chicken fried steak.
Oh.
Yes.
Might have been Tyler from
it could have been. I mean, my answer to chicken fried steak in the book is, and that's pretty much everyone does a little different, but they're frying some kind of steak or cutlet, is I did a pan-fried pork loin yard with a little bit of a brown butter parsley lemon sauce.
Well, this book is very much center of the plate protein.
Yes, and I'm unabashedly about at the center of the plate steak.
Yeah, I'll bet the vegetarian percentage of the population in Texas is kind of low.
Well, it depends on where you... In Austin, you would be surprised.
Okay, all right. So.
You
would
be surprised, but you know what? If you look at the vegetable inside chapter in the book, that was really the most difficult as far as paring down number of recipes, because we do so many great sides at all the different restaurants, and growing up, I was used to always having great vegetables on the table.
One here everybody talks about, is it achiote?
Achote seared
chickpeas. That's something I expect that we're going to be having, right?
Well, and the background on that dish, growing up in West Texas in a ranching family, in the summertime we would always have the camp cook who was, like in the old movies, actually cooking 3 meals a day over the campfire with Dutch ovens, feeding cowboys breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And Lilo, our old camp cook, used to do something with chickpeas, which he would saute with a lot of chili peppers and garlic and spicy, and finish them off with some cheddar cheese. So when we started doing restaurants, I kind of cityfied his version, he used hominy. Instead of hominy, I used chickpeas, and then added some goat cheese, some arugula, some achiote oil.
Well, everybody must be eating that one, because that's what everybody's raving about.
You know, that's been on our menus at the restaurants, I'd guess, for 10 to 15 years, and every time we pull it off, people say, no, you got to put it back on.
So do you get fresh chickpeas in Texas?
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah, there you go. Our minds go in the same direction. It's really,
no,
really scary.
Occasionally you do, but the basis of that dish is using the dried chickpeas.
Dried chickpeas.
We dry and reconstitute and cook them, and then we do the saute with them.
Well, you know, we actually had fresh chickpeas this year.
I love fresh chickpeas.
But, you know, they really are a pain to peel.
Yes, they are. And when you're doing a restaurant where you're serving 100-plus customers a night, it would be a nightmare to try to peel enough of orders of chickpeas.
Somebody said, though, that if you roast them in the skin, that then you just sort of rub it off like hazelnuts, and it's easier.
Well, but just like hazelnuts, it's easier, but it's still not
easy. Hey, a few weeks ago, we were talking to somebody who grows black walnuts.
He said
you just crushed the whole thing.
Well, it's like I just did a dinner, and we did our version of chilies in nogada, which has a walnut cream sauce. But part of the magic of that sauce is you have to clean those walnuts and get all the skin off.
Oh, sure.
And when I agreed to do this for 100 people, I thought, this won't be that tough. But about an hour into peeling walnuts, I was going, who agreed to do this? And I went, I did.
Do you yourself eat like this, Lou?
I am very particular on what I eat, not from a culinary standpoint, but from
health.
A freshness and health. And I'm 53 years old, and I still work out and eat really healthy. And I'm not, I don't think, consider myself thin, but I've had doing cooking demonstrations, people say, well, how can you be a chef and not be, be big and robust? And I'm going, well, you know what? In my opinion, if anybody should know about food, it's a chef. We should know more about nutrition. We should have the foods, great fresh and nutritious foods available. So I think if anybody should be healthy, it should be a chef.
Well, you know, all these chefs are slimming down now. Mark Bittman, I think he lost 40 pounds because his doctor said he was killing himself with the way he was eating.
Yes.
And so he now eats vegan up until dinner time. And then he has a much smaller center of the plate protein than he used to have.
Well, I restrict myself during the week. I try to eat healthy 3 meals a day. And then I have one day, which is always Sunday, that anything and everything is available.
Okay. But, you know, I mean, I could just see where a diet of all this red meat protein could not be very helpful.
But it's like Julia Child said, butter is not bad for you. It's just everything in moderation.
Yeah, most people don't understand moderation, though.
Not anymore.
Now, here's a light one. The roasted halibut is very good, and saffron tomato broth.
Oh, see, that is a great dish. And I think if you really dig in this book, it does represent the way I eat, in that there's a lot of vegetables, a lot of foods that are going back to the way our grandparents used to do it, which is you take the time and prepare them right and don't worry about slow cooking or time it takes to prepare it.
You have actually a number of seafood dishes in here, too. I was surprised by that.
And if you really look at Texas, and even though I grew up in West Texas, my father and his family are from Louisiana and then the Port Arthur area, and there's great seafood available here from the Gulf of Mexico. And even some of the big ranches down in South Texas are right there by the coast. So people a lot of times don't think about that, but seafood is a big part of our diet in parts of Texas.
Now let's move on to a related and interesting subject, which is wine in Texas.
Yes.
Now let me preface this by saying that the one time we ate at the mansion on Turtle Creek, we decided we would have fun with the sommelier because it's kind of a stuffy sort of place. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I said here's the deal, sir. We make it a practice to drink wine of the region we're in, whether it's Italy or France or Germany or Spain or wherever it is. We always try to take in a wine that's from there. So your task is to provide us with a white wine and a red wine that come from Texas. And after he picked himself up off the floor, he actually had a book of Texas wines.
Yeah.
And he served as a quite respectable Chardonnay and an excellent Cabernet Sauvignon. So the Texas wine industry, and I've read recently, is growing and flourishing. Do you try to do something with that in your restaurants?
Yeah, at all the restaurants, we have a good representation of Texas wines. And I'm old enough to have seen kind of the growth in the industry and some of the struggles with producing some good wines. And it's taken us a while, but I think we have some of the best wines available. I mean, maybe it's all in the eyes of the beholder, but I think we produce some great wines that marry well and go well with the foods that we produce here.
My guess is that if you grow grapes to make wine in Texas, you're really dedicated.
Yes.
So because it's a challenge, so what goes into the barrel, what comes out in the bottle is something you really cared about.
And I see some of these folks that have been doing this for 20 years, and they have really stuck it out and persevered, and I think it shows in the wines that they're producing today.
Now, the guy, the first African-American wine producer, it was from Texas in the U.S.
Yeah, I don't know. That wasn't where his property was, though, I don't think.
That's where he fell in love with wine.
Yeah, his name was McDonald.
And I've heard of him, and I don't know all of the backstory.
Yeah, I think his wine property is in California. I don't think it's in Texas.
Yeah.
He just simply wasn't. He grew up as a poor colored man in the Fort Worth area, but somewhere along the way he had a glass of Burgundy, so he decided that he was going to go Pinot Noir. Now that's probably the last grape you'd try to plant in Texas.
It's tough, and I mean not just our wine industry, but here I shouldn't say recently they've been trying for, again, 10 to 20 years was olive production. And just recently, they have just harvested the first commercial olive harvest. And I think it stands on par with anything being done in California, but it's being produced down in the Eagle Pass, South Texas region, and some fantastic olive groves down there.
Well, they produce olive oil, a good quality olive oil, in Israel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but Israel's not quite as warm as Texas.
Well,
I mean, Israel's the home of the olive and also the home of the grape.
The temperature, are you still suffering there? Are you roasting?
It's starting to cool down, meaning that we're breaking 100 degrees, like 98, 99.
Oh, wow. I feel so bad, Lou.
but I've been spending a little time. We ranch out in the Marfa area, which is far west Texas, and that's more high desert, so we're in the upper 80s, low 90s. But at least out there, it cools down at night into the 60s. Whereas I'm in north Texas right now, it's 100 plus every day with it. 10, 11 o'clock at night, it's still in the upper 90s, and
Wow. We
may get in the low 80s by in the morning.
Well, we've had Texas on the program a lot recently. We've had Austin on the program a lot. We're not threatening to come to Austin. We're going to come and see you. Would November be a good month to come to Austin?
I would wait until October or November. unless you enjoy the heat.
No, not really.
Well, actually, I do enjoy heat, but not when it's breaking 100 now.
But you know what? When I was in San Francisco, one of the other key factors of me eventually moving back to Texas was, in San Francisco, I never could feel the sun, and I was cold all the time.
Yeah, well, we just got back from Oregon, and if it were a different climate, Peter would really want to live there. But it's just that rainy stuff, you know.
Rain and cold all the time. And I just, growing up in Texas, I miss feeling the sun on my skin.
Well, listen, Lewis, we're going to come and see you real soon. In the meantime, listeners, you got to get Big Ranch, Big City Cookbook and study how they eat in Texas, because it's not anywhere like you think.
Yes, it's a very sophisticated book. And Lou, congratulations on completing it.
Thank you.
It was a major labor of love to do this, I'm sure.
Yes, you know, it was a great project, and I didn't know that I would enjoy it so much, and it to the point that I called my co-author June Naylor and told her, "Are you ready to do another book?"
So, oh, wow.
So I would like to. I enjoy it, but I think I'll keep my day job as a chef.
Yes. Okay, well, I'm going to go fix me some green chili grits.
All right. Folks, thank you very much.
Lewis, thank you.
And we'll be right back on the other side of the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back.
Gobba, 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 hey.
Gobba, 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 hey. I think we're just going to allow Stephen Gadula to tell his story.
Well, you never know what you don't know until all of a sudden you find something out. And I just did, picking up a book called Gobba, Gobba, Hey by Stephen Gadula, who we're actually interviewing now, all about something that was supposed to be part of my childhood growing up in Pittsburgh. I had never heard of a gob, Stephen.
Well, I've run into some people from Pennsylvania who have been familiar with it and some who haven't, like yourself. And I have had a great time talking with people from the Northeast. As you know, there's a bit of a gob versus whoopie pie.
Oh, yeah.
War that's been going on good-naturedly.
And then a competition between Pittsburgh and someplace elsewhere.
Yes, with Maine. Primarily.
Okay. Yeah. And then we haven't even got into the mud pie issue.
And we have not even, you're right. That's something entirely different. But I was raised calling this confection a gob. I was not familiar with a whoopie pie until I went to Penn State. And most of my friends were from around the Pittsburgh area, a few from Philadelphia. And I started to notice then that there was certainly, this was a good example of American regional foodways, although I wouldn't have been able to identify it as such at the time. And I found that there were people who were saying, oh, yes, that's a very common Pennsylvania Dutch treat. But,
yeah, it would be Pennsylvania Dutch, wouldn't it?
Right. In which case it's from further east in the state, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, we wouldn't have much to do with it, really.
Now, the funny part about it is in my native land, it's a rude word.
Oh, yeah.
What is gob?
Yeah, I mean, if
what
you,
does it mean?
it means mouth in a not very complimentary fashion.
Right. So, and so. I also know it as slang for a sailor, which is actually, I think, for some commercial gob makers, that is their logo that they use as a sailor.
And then what about gobstruck? Isn't it?
Gobstruck? That I'm not completely familiar with.
I think that's like awestruck, but with your mouth open.
There you go.
Well, listen, why don't you define from your perspective what exactly a gob is, Stephen?
Certainly. Well, it's funny because it was a question that I was asked a lot as I was standing on street corners in San Francisco back in the spring of 2009 as passersby would sort of look curiously at this saran-wrapped confection that I had on a tray, and they would say, do I want to buy a gob? And I would say, yes. And I was surprised that people did not know what that was. So I had to go into an explanation, and I would say, well, if you would cut the head off of one cupcake and then sort of decapitate another and stick those two domes together with frosting, you would have a gob. And people would say, oh, so it's an inside-out cupcake.
Uh-huh, cute.
And I said, yeah. Sort of, and that became one of my marketing tags, if you will.
Yeah, let's define the fact. You, in fact, are a freelance writer by trade.
Yes, I am.
And you picked up and moved from the East Coast to San Francisco, and commissions or the assignments were coming in too slowly to afford a lifestyle in San Francisco, and so you took to making gobs and joined part of the street food movement and food truck movement in San Francisco. Is that
correct. It was the scene was very nascent at the time, and yes, I had moved here shortly after my last book, The Warmest Room in the House.
Which is also your website, right?
That's one of my websites.
A blog site.
I had a companion blog for the book, The Warmest Room in the House, and then when I started having the gob business taking off, I had to, of course, have a website for that as well. And I split my posting between the two. Of course, now with the gob book getting more attention, I'm focusing on that. But I had moved here, and assignments were dwindling, and page counts in magazines were dwindling, and I was having a tough time establishing a career here in the West Coast, and having a book out really didn't mean anything at that point. Everybody was struggling. Writers everywhere were looking for work, and I had noticed while scrolling through the Internet one night, I saw a posting on chow.com, which is a very popular
food-based
website here in San Francisco, that readers were talking about just a few handful of street carts that were out in the Mission. And it seemed to be a bit of an underground scene, and I read a little bit more about it, and they were talking about street food, and more than just food that was sold on the street, but also the cultural significance of those foods. For instance, there was a gentleman who was selling curry, chicken curry, and it was based upon his travels through Southeast Asia. And so it was a skill he had learned, and he was out on the street selling small cups of curry. And I thought, well, what is my equivalent of street food? And with my Hungarian and Slovak background, I thought, well, I certainly can't go out with halushki or any of those items. And I thought for a minute about making something that my grandmother had made, which was called palincha. I'm going to get it wrong.
I know what you're saying,
It's like a crepe, but it's...
Exactly. What are those called? I mean, it does begin with a P.
Well, they're not the subject of the interview anyway, so they really don't matter.
Exactly. I'm just embarrassed that they took off
in Texas, of all places, which I thought was very funny.
It is interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, so back to your story.
Yeah, so I thought, well, that was something that I could sell that had cultural significance to me. But then I started to remember the gods, how ubiquitous they were. And they were, from my childhood, the closest thing to street food, because you really could find them on a folding card table at a car wash or a gas station, just at the cash register, wrapped in saran wrap, obviously made by somebody in the neighborhood, and usually in a little little basket. Or you could find them, let's say, at any number of local town picnic for sale, usually for a quarter. Everybody had their own recipe, and they were always wrapped the same way, saran wrap, so that when you would open the gob up, that was part of the joy, was that you ran your finger along that imprint of chocolate that was left because it was so moist. And I was going to say, and I thought, well, this is what I can do. And I did not see anybody doing anything similar at the time. And I was very careful, being new to the city. I didn't want to step on anybody else's toes. I didn't know the culinary turf here at all.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is something I can do. And when I went out on the street for the first time and encountered people and had the question, well, what is a gob? I realized, oh, geez, I've got my work cut out for me here.
Well, you certainly have made great progress. Your book includes one different recipe for gobs for every week of the year.
Yes, ma'am.
And you start out with the original chocolate and vanilla gobs, which everybody would be accustomed to. But boy, you move far afield. You jumped into the whole food scene in San Francisco and also into the farmer's market scene. And right number three here is orange, cardamom, ginger gobs with saffron filling. Now, that's a long way from where you grew up.
It is, and it's also a long way from where my own kitchen had started. And you are correct. I completely dove in headfirst. And somebody had commented while reading through the galleys of the book that there was really a sense of discovery with each recipe heading, and that they could tell that I was really receiving a hands-on education. And that was coming from a couple of places. I was homesick. This was the farthest I'd ever moved. I could always get home within a 3 to 3.5 hour drive on the East Coast from various points where I lived after college. And I was now here on the West Coast. And there was a bit of culture shock, but I had to get up every morning. We need to work. We need to do something. We need to feel like we are contributing. And when I started baking the gobs, I realized, well, people here in San Francisco have very adventurous palates. And I was discovering the city's scene as well, places like Humphrey Slocum Ice Cream.
Oh, yes. I mean, I still have yet to get there. I just love their flavors.
They are genius.
Yeah, they
really are genius. And
I love the funny rules they have about people going in there. They're really eccentric geniuses, or genius eccentrics, I guess.
Absolutely. And Jake Gondry had worked for a while with Daniel Patterson over at
Trois.
Yes. So the more I was baking, I sort of drew my strength and my courage from the things that were happening in places like Humphrey Slocum or at Dynamo Donuts, where the proprietor, Sarah, is equally just adventurous and so, like Jake, a genius. And I looked around at all of this and I thought, okay, my parents always cooked with instinct and also with whatever was on hand in the cupboards. And I thought, I can do this. I have a good sense of what flavors go together. I can make this happen. I can produce gob flavors that are equal in some ways to the other adventurous flavor combinations that are available here in the city and other confections.
You've got some savory ones too, right?
Well, savory.
No, I don't see any savory ones.
There are some. Yeah, sure there are. There's one with chocolate and bacon in it.
Well, that's not savory.
That's what you call it.
Well, I mean, it's still sweet.
Itself, the inherent sweetness of pork does really lend itself well to confections. So I think that that is sort of a sweet and savory combo.
Okay. Of course, that's the direction confections are taking now anyhow.
Yes, right. And with a lot of the finishing salts that you see on top of a lot of the caramels and chocolates. And actually, it's funny that you bring that up, because one day, last Thanksgiving, when I was making the buttered rum frosting, I just sprinkled some kosher salt on top. I had a half of a gob dome left over with some frosting on it, and I thought, I'm going to just put some salt on top of this. And it was spectacular. It was just really delicious.
You must be doing all right with this, because you know, I read how you were so frustrated with what you could afford by way of living accommodations in a miserable kitchen. And now you tell us that when we're talking about the landline, that your house is under construction. I don't know if you moved or you're remodeling or whatever, but you must be doing all right with the garbs.
Well, we bought a... as I've grown fond of saying, we didn't buy a fixer-upper. We bought a tear-downer.
Uh-huh.
And by San Francisco real estate standards, it was what we could afford. And it was easier for us. We needed to relocate. We were running out of time, and we had to be here. We found this place, knew it needed an awful lot of work, and just set our goal of, okay, we have... My father always used to say to me, Stephen, I had an 8-year plan, and I did it in 5 years, talking about remodeling the house that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And I think that we probably have a 10-year plan, and it might get done in 12 years.
Oh, dear. So you're in the same kitchen.
Well, I moved into a commercial kitchen immediately.
Oh, right. That's true. I missed that step. But are you still living in the same miserable house?
We are living through the construction.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And but you're making some... profit off of this, I gather.
The business is supporting itself.
Okay.
And the writing has helped to support me.
Oh,
so
good.
The business makes a small profit. Not enough to remodel a house.
Okay. I just wanted to clear the decks on that. And I guess you need to tell us how to get these gobs if you're not in San Francisco. You make them yourself. You use the recipes that you provided.
Correct.
52 of them. Do you
correct.
Do any other sales? You mentioned you were thinking of wholesaling and that sort of thing.
Well, I sell through two means. I sell through, actually, I guess three. I have a monthly newsletter that goes out. I call my list the Gobsters, and these are people who have either followed me on Twitter, have introduced themselves, come up and introduced themselves to me at various festivals, left their email addresses, and once a month I send out an email alert to this group letting them know what flavors are available for FedEx shipping and for local delivery in the Bay Area. And they are sold by the dozen. It's usually a mix of two or three flavors. I try to do something seasonal in keeping in with what's available at the local farmers markets at that time. People can also log on to foodzee.com, and that is F-O-O-D-Z, as in zoo, I-E. So foodzee.com. I have a store on their website from which people can order. And also, if people just want to shoot me an email at gabagabahay, just like the name of my business, at gmail.com, I'm always happy to accommodate orders that way.
And, of course, the gabagabahay title comes from a Ramones.
Yes, I took it.
Great
funny.
Ramones.
Yes, and what I thought was funny about that, and it just goes, again, to show how I was needing to educate people about the gob, is that the Ramones refrain is actually Gabba Gabba Hey, and I thought that everybody would immediately get the little tweaking there by calling the business Gabba Gabba Hey, and there were just blank looks from people.
Because nobody remembers the Ramones.
Well, no, they remembered the Ramones just fine, but what they didn't understand was the approximation and the tweaking of the title.
Oh, how funny.
And I would have to say, no, gob, gab. Yeah. But it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience, and it was a great deal of fun to write the book. And as you know, there's a wonderful supportive food community here in San Francisco. And
we will check out Twitter next time we're in San Fran.
Please
and
do.
See if you're out in the street anywhere.
Well, I don't do that any longer. Thank goodness. That had its own learning curve.
I'm sure.
And lessons learned as well. But it's been wonderful. And it's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you so much.
It's fun talking to you. I feel like we're related in some regard here.
Of course. Well,
even though I've never had a gob in my whole entire life.
Well, we can take care of that.
Okay, Stephen. Well, I wish you continued success. You seem
Thank
to
you
be
so much.
Taking off in grand style here. All right, so keep us posted.
I definitely will. Please stay in touch yourselves and have a great Labor Day weekend.
And
back
you
there.
Too.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye
you,
now.
Steve.
I feel a little bit like saying this was a community service announcement, equal time for gobbers, for Lewis Lambert and Scott Dolich. What an interesting program it's been, and we hope you enjoyed it and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.